Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Our guest tonight is Brian McAllister, longtime player, who will discuss some of the promos he's played in the past and some current. Brian visited with us 3 weeks ago, and we didn't get through all the questions we had at that time, so we lassoed him and made him come back again. Now, the October 4th show is the first interview with Brian, so if you like tonight, you may want to go back into the archives and check out that one. We've been following the betting on the presidential election. We're not taking sides on who is the one to bet on or who is the one to vote for, but if we can make money on the election, we definitely want to do on the gambling. So, Michael, what are the latest odds?
The latest Pinnacle odds are Obama minus 213, Romney plus 191. If we split the difference, that implies that Obama has a 66.9% chance of winning and Romney 33.1%. Not much different from where it was last week.
Uh-huh. Now, you said Pinnacle Sports.
Yes, I did.
They have been in the news.
Yes, they were in the paper today. The person who runs Cantor Sportsbook here was evidently somehow mixed up with Pinnacle as well and was arrested for it, as well as some other people.
All right. So now how does that affect betting on stuff?
Well, Pinnacle already was closed to U.S. players directly. However, U.S. players have been known to use backdoors to bet on Pinnacle anyway. And I think that the Justice Department just arrested some people manning this backdoor.
Uh-huh. So they're going to be closing the back doors.
Well, who knows what they're going to do? I've been out running around all day. But as far as I know, it's still possible for Americans to bet on Pinnacle, except perhaps if one of their own agents was one of the ones who got arrested. Who knows? We'll talk about it more next week.
All right. Very good. Something extraordinary happened in the online poker tournament this past week. Dan Smith was playing the PokerStars Sunday Millions tournament. Now, Dan Smith is on top of several organizations' Player of the Year for poker tournaments, and this is an online tournament. It's not usual that they're in both, but he did well. So when they got down to five players, they took time out to split the pot. Now, Dan had 45% of the chips at the time, and they offered him a guaranteed $200,000, round numbers, which was $12,000 less than the full value of first prize. So if he could have refused it and played on hoping to win the 212, or he could have taken the 200 guaranteed. He took the guarantee. And then the other fours got a certain amount. But also they kept 20,000 to play for. So these last five players played for 20,000. Now Dan won that too. So he won 220,000, whereas first prize was only 212,000. So this is extremely unusual. Usually when you split the pot a bit, you end up taking less for the guarantee, but somehow he ended up with more, which is pretty impressive.
I wonder why the other players made this deal unless he had just a super majority of the chips.
He had 45%.
Yeah, I don't know why they would agree to that deal then.
Apparently, somebody there was relatively new to tournament poker and didn't understand how to translate percentage of chips into a settlement. It's a fairly standard formula, but it's not intuitively obvious. It's not real simple if you haven't done it before.
Well, I think that if all the players are equally skilled, the way I would do it is to say, okay, let's divvy up this percentage of the pot according and in proportion to chip stack, and the rest of it we'll play for to keep it interesting, and because the winner should get something.
Well, that would be one thing to start out with, but it is a negotiation between five players. And negotiations can go in several different directions. So, anyway, Halloween's coming up next week. Now, many local casinos will have multiple points for the day. For me personally, I'm going to be playing at South Point, where their double point coupons is the best one in town, in my opinion, for what I play for. Some people dress up with costumes on Halloween. Now, casinos get nervous about players wearing masks while gambling, and especially nervous if you approach a casino cage while wearing a mask. Some players have been backed off from playing certain table games in the past without a mask use a mask on Halloween as an opportunity to play unrecognized. This kind of reminds me of a story about Tommy Hyland. It wasn't Halloween, but it was Christmas. One year, he went to Atlantic City Casino dressed as Santa Claus and fired away, and he got barred. So the pit boss barred Santa Claus. He laughed while he did it, but he barred him. So I that's always a cute story. Very good. So let's talk about Brian. Brian McAllister is an advantage player who started playing in casinos in 1989, which is when he was only 17. He got better when he went to college, Caltech, which is where he hooked up with a fellow student that we'll call Sam. In the October 4th interview, we talked mostly about the good old days, although we have a couple questions on that. Most of today's interview will be about current gambling matters. Brian McAllister, welcome back to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. How are you?
We are well. Good. All right. Now, one time you and Sam took some playing cards from Samstown Casino, and you took them downtown. Now, presumably, these had the corners chopped off, which is the only way you could get it. And then, just for giggles, you threw some on the ground near a blackjack table. What happened?
Okay, so this is actually one of the one of my favorite stories to tell. So, basically, you know, growing up and certainly going to a college like Caltech, we had a tradition of pranks, and that was something that you know, I certainly still have a lot of value in. But so my friend Sam and I just decided to do something that was completely harmless, but what we figured, you know, might be something that you know, the casino might not appreciate so much. So he happened to have some cards from Samstown, which have a completely different back than the cards that they used at the particular downtown casino that we were at, and it was very, very crowded. And we just wanted to see what would happen if he dropped some of these cards in the ground, because, you know, basically there are a few things that casinos just do not like, and one of them is seeing cards on the floor, especially near a blackjack table.
Looks like somebody's cheating.
What's that?
It looks like somebody is cheating.
Well, and not particularly well. I mean,
yes.
So it's just something, you know, so out of the ordinary that they, you know, and sure enough, like, we were able to drop the cards and sort of, you know, go a fair distance away and, you know, be surreptitious enough about it. And again, we didn't really think through a lot of the consequences in case, you know, but then again, I mean, I don't know if there's anything particularly illegal about, aside from littering, about that particular thing, but we sort of watched, and all this, and then, you know, a few minutes later, like, the people in suits just started to descend on this table, and I mean, they were just hovering around. I mean, there are just few things a casino likes less than seeing cards on the floor near a blackjack table. So it was just something that that we did just for kicks, and yeah, one of the stories we didn't get to last time.
All right, so you didn't get in any trouble for it.
No. And there's not a lot of expected value in that. In fact, it's probably a negative edge play when you think about it.
Well, it depends on how much value you place on being able to giggle hysterically inside of a casino.
Oh, yeah.
Well, speaking of throwing cards around and Halloween, last year for Halloween, I passed out playing cards. I passed out full decks of casino cards to all the kids that came to my house, or at least the teenagers, and thinking, you know, they'd probably be happy to get something besides candy for a change. And so everything seemed to go fine. A lot of them seemed to be very grateful. So the next morning, I go out to get the paper, and everywhere in front of my house was just littered with playing cards. I think a bunch of them just opened up the deck and just tossed them in the air.
Not a lot of potential gamblers in your neighborhood, huh?
No.
All right.
So I don't know what it is, but something must be fun about just tossing playing cards around.
Well, maybe they're going to Caltech and they're getting practice on the pranks early.
Yeah, we do a little card tossing too, but that's a different thing.
All right. So when a casino deals a new table game you've never seen before, what kind of analysis do you do to decide whether or not you're going to attack it?
Okay, so that's a serious question now. So basically, you know, what I really want to make clear is that there are a lot of things with gambling, and certainly gambling with an edge, that just involve a little bit of extra thought. A lot of times what you can do is take something at face value and then notice a lot of extra details about that. And then sometimes you can come to appropriate conclusions. So, you know, a very basic example that everybody is probably familiar with is something like blackjack. So somebody comes along, you know, a long time ago and just realizes that, you know, in this game, there is actually some memory. So the cards that have been played affect the state of whatever the upcoming gamble is. And so after some development, came up with a strategy for counting cards. So someone could actually sit there and keep track of what's happened and then identify when positive situations show up and then bet a whole lot when this happens. And then in response to this, you know, the casino will start to notice these sort of betting patterns, and so people have to disguise this. And so the next step of that would be to, you know, do different types of team play. I mean, that the certainly the strategy that was popularized by the MIT team, and I'm sure a lot of other teams, and, you know, has been available to the public. Basically, it was portrayed in a book and a movie and all sorts of other things. But the idea would be to have somebody that they could just call in that would just basically flat bet a large amount of money. So nobody's varying their bets, but basically, you know, someone's basically getting a whole lot of money in when there's advantage. And then, you know, there's all sorts of variations of this where people can bet in combinations to sort of hide what they're doing. And then the casinos then figure this out, and then they start introducing things like shuffle machines. And then some people notice that maybe the shuffle machine is a little bit too high up on the table. And so when the dealer is passing out cards, that, you know, sometimes the dealer can, you know, accidentally flash the bottom of his hole card. And of course, that changes fundamentally the payout of the game as well. And so this thing sort of just goes back and forth for a long time. And then and casinos, of course, are always bringing on new games and new sorts of experiences. And so the idea is that you want to know what you're dealing with on the face of it. And I must say, I'm a huge fan of your website, the Wizard of Odds, because you've done a lot of the homework already as far as analyzing the game just on the face of it, what you're dealing with. Then there are, you know, additional phases of analysis where you can, you know, take advantage of, like I said, different things that come up that are particular to these games. So
now, Michael's website normally doesn't deal with collusion. Michael's websites assume you play fairly according to the way that the game designer meant you to play. And advantage players look for other ways to play the game, which are dealer mistakes, holes in the rules, something. So how do you find these things, or how do you discover these things?
Well, you know, specifically about the website, I mean, that what's good is you need to fully understand the fundamentals of the game. And I guess, you know, the game as dealt or as intended by the game designer, it's very important to know. Even if a game has negative edge, there's still generally an optimal way of playing it, and it's very important to know how to do that and exactly what sort of numbers you're talking about. But, you know, for instance, there are certain types of games where, blackjack being an example, of course, you know, that have a history, and some of that history is the cards that were dealt. Well, even games that are shuffled every time, there are certainly cards dealt to the people sitting next to you. And at times, the casino may or may not have a stated policy about sharing that information, but most times they don't particularly care if you're kind of sloppy holding your cards back. I mean, it's not going to work very well in a bridge tournament, but if you're just sitting at a casino table, then, you know, showing your hand to people who are not involved in your outcome is not necessarily a bad thing to do strategically. So if you, you know some of the breakdown of how these sort of patterns of cards exist, then oftentimes you have an advantage where you previously did not, because the knowledge of this extra information changes your strategy. And the more that your strategy can change, generally the more of an advantage something like this represents.
This website, discountgambling.net, is really good for taking advantage of collusion. And Stephen Howe, the webmaster there, notes how at the Barona Casino with Mississippi Stud, for example, they dealt the game face up, so you didn't even need to bother colluding because you could see everything. And he provides a collusion strategy for that game. Usually, in my opinion, I mean, it's certainly good to collude if you can, but lots of times it doesn't get you above the house advantage, or if so, not very much. What I've found is that with new games, you would think the casino would put some of their best dealers on it because it's a new game and they want something good, who's a dealer who's going to get the rules right and deal it properly. But lots of times they put some of their worst dealers on these games. And I think that if you go in there just knowing the rules and the basic strategy, that just catching a one dealer mistake per hour or two is enough to put the odds in your favor a little bit.
They are. And Richard Munchkin says that when he plays these kind of games, and he knows the rules better than the pit boss does. And so if there's a dispute, frequently when the pit boss has to come over and read the table to find out what the payoffs are, Richard knows that that guy does not have a clue as to what Richard is doing. And so that is often the case where a single pit might have eight different carnival games in it, and most pit bosses are not experts at any of them, let alone all of them.
But they will still pretend to be, and so if you question the dealer about a call, like, you know, no, that's, you should have paid me this, and the dealer will say, no, the rules are that, and you say, well, call over the pit boss. I've noticed that the pit boss will just automatically agree with the dealer, hoping to make it two against one. But if you still don't agree, no, say the rules of this game are this, and, you know, show me the rules in writing to prove me wrong. And, you know, as a last resort, take it to gaming, because as you said, lots of times both the dealer and the floorman won't know the rules, but they will pretend they do, and they will rule in the dealer's favor most of the time.
Before we go on to something else, do you have anything in this general thread to add, Brian?
Well, yeah, actually, it's funny you mentioned Mississippi Stud. I mean, that's a fairly well-known example of, you know, if you happen to see the dealer's hole card, I mean, that's actually like a 50% advantage or something ridiculous like that. I mean, there are other games where knowing the dealer's hole card is a small edge, but that's a particularly egregious one, I think.
Yeah, hole carding. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, fine.
I was going to say that hole carding is the king of big advantages in playing the new carnival games. And, of course, not every dealer exposes the hole card, but still enough of them do to make it worthwhile. And as you mentioned before, lots of times if the shuffler is in an uncomfortable spot for the dealer or there's things in the way, he will have to, you know, turn his wrist and sometimes expose a card to the right position. And that's something that good players keep an eye out for.
I found it curious about 5 minutes ago, Michael. You said always collude if you get the chance. Now, Michael is a very moral man. And the idea that he's saying, oh, collusion is a good thing, whereas outside of a casino advantage play, collusion is frequently illegal, frequently considered a bad thing. But Michael said, always collude when you can.
Well, it depends on the type of collusion. I would be against, for example, the dealer and the player colluding somehow to cheat the casino, or in poker, if two players were colluding to raise up the pot to drive, to win more money from another player. That's absolutely unethical. But if you're playing, say, Mississippi Stud, and the dealer does not mind if you show each other your cards, then go ahead and do it.
All right. Very good. Now, videopoker.com is one of our sponsors, and they have a website with a forum on there where people post emails back and forth. I'm fairly active on that forum. There's a current thread related to who is a professional gambler and who is not. Some of the posters argued that if you have a job that pays more than your gambling pays, then you're not a professional gambler. Brian, what's your take on this?
So I saw your email about that, and I went to the site. I've never posted in this particular forum, but I read the thread that you were talking about, and I find it very interesting. And in fact, it's not just that people think that there's a big distinction between being a professional and not being a professional, but it seems to strike a very emotional sort of chord with people. Like they feel kind of defensive about wanting to play negative games or something like that. It's just something that's sort of interesting. I mean, the way that I look at it, and I've always been employed other than gambling. I mean, I've always treated that as just a hobby, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I have to do bad things. You can still, have a hobby that is profitable. And in fact, having another source of income actually relieves some of the pressure that you'd experience as a gambler, because you don't have to take advantage of things. You can go for months at a time without having a worthwhile play. I've been several times to Vegas where I haven't put a nickel into a machine just because I wanted to enjoy the company of my friends and just kind of hang out and do other things in town.
How weird.
But yeah, I mean, you really have to decide what you're trying to maximize, and for most people, on a recreational level, they're trying to maximize their amount of recreation. Now, this happens to usually be highly correlated to your money. From my point of view, if you're certainly going to have a recreational pursuit such as this, it behooves you to have one that's sustainable, and the only way you're going to do that is to play games that have an edge. I don't think that it's, people are certainly, within their rights to have opinions about this and in fact their own levels of recreation. But from my point of view, you can sort of define a professional as somebody who is, I guess, competent at what they do. That wouldn't be the kind of definition that you would use in sports or anything like that. But I don't know. I mean, whether or not I'm a professional gambler, it doesn't seem to me to be a very big distinction. I know the IRS would not consider me to be a professional gambler. I think I would pay less tax if I could convince them of this, but I just happen to have more of my pursuit going to my job than my gambling. So, you've had a lot of tax-related guests.
So in your mind, like, were the on the University of Southern California has a football team that is frequently ranked very high, and so the players on that are officially amateurs, but from your point of view, they would be pros. They are highly competent as to what they do. They are doing it in a way to maximize long-term income. And so by your definition, they would be pros, even if the NCAA says, nope, they're amateurs.
Yeah, and even the Olympics relaxed this. I remember, you know, a long time ago, the U.S. would not be competitive in certain sports because they didn't allow what they term professional players. So even though we might have a, you know, dominant share of that market, it wasn't until they started allowing dream teams and whatever to show up that that we didn't start, you know, winning these gold medals and things.
I agree, by the way. I think that college sports, for the most part, is played by professionals, and I think that it's I don't know. I think it's not very honest to say that these are college students. And furthermore, I think that the state of Nevada agrees because we're not supposed to be allowed to gamble on so-called amateur sports legally, like the Olympics. Nevertheless, you can bet on college football and basketball because I think that the state views it as, you know, as a professional sport.
Well, possibly, but depending on, like, your alma mater is University of California, Santa Barbara. The players on that football team basically had no shot at being a professional player on Sunday. Maybe one every 6 years makes it, but it's really no shot. So they would be amateurs, wouldn't they?
I think for the non-televised sports, that's legitimate, and those are amateurs, and they're playing for the love of the sport. But UCSB has a pretty good basketball team.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine that some of the better players on the team probably do have aspirations of being pro. But I don't know UCSB's situation well enough to really take a stand. But I question how much time in class and studying, say, the football players at LSU are spending.
Yep. On
some, I'm sure they beat Caltech.
Yeah, I don't recall hearing any Caltech player made professional football teams.
But they did win a basketball game and they went and made a movie about it.
A basketball game after losing 89 in a row, and boy, there was bonfires that night. Okay.
I hear that you were in a recent slot tournament where there were some strange rules. The interesting part was how you found out about those rules and how you exploited them. Can you tell us more about it?
Sure. So this was it's a recent slot tournament. It was an invitation event. However, you could actually buy into it. What was interesting about it is that the rules that they'd sent in the mailer weren't very clear. What it basically said was that over the course of 4 days, you could play each day, and then your top three scores out of the four would combine to form your total, which is what you would compare with all the other participants. So if you wanted to, you could just play for 3 days, and that would just be your score. There was a rebuy option, which the mailer had said for $100, you could rebuy to replace a bad score with a good one, and you could do this once each day. Now, of course, given that information, it's not particularly clear what that means. Does this mean I can play eight times and take the best three of those eight? Did it mean that I could replace my lowest score cumulatively? Did it mean that I could take an option on a fresh score each day? Or basically, that making that rebuy decision is very heavily dependent on what the conditions of contest were. So I had to go and talk to the different tournament organizers and things just to try to get a definitive answer. And fortunately, they had a very well-constructed set of rules. I know that that's not always the case, that they deal with all of the possibilities. But I think it's certainly very important for organizations to running things like this to have very well-defined rules, because otherwise it makes for disasters later. But what they explained to me was that each day, if you chose to rebuy to replace your score, you were locked into the rebuy score. So they essentially threw away your first score and then kept your second one if you chose to do that, and you had to pay $100 to do that. The other thing
was, if you had a high score, you should not rebuy, and if you had a lousy score, you should. If you knew it was high or you knew it was low.
Right. And, you know, banging away for 5 minutes on a slot machine that's very, very high expectation. These things are designed to make it more interesting, so almost every spin is a win. It's difficult to figure out what a reasonable score is. So you know, if you're planning to do some homework about this, then you have to kind of stick around and sample other people's results, perhaps talk to the staff about it. The staff are actually instructed not to share information of that sort with people. You could kind of coax some things out of them, but it wasn't, they really were trying to stick to that particular thing, so I didn't really bug them too much about it. But just going around and observing people's scores relative to the time they had left and taking note of where how often the jackpots seem to come, because the jackpots really dominated the results. If you weren't getting those, you definitely weren't getting a good score. And, you know, over time, you know, based on the scores that I have accumulated in combination with the list of the payoff prizes, you can kind of estimate your expected value for different sorts of things. So some scores you might want to throw away, but it's even possible that you would have a low score and not want to replace it, because if you didn't have any chance of winning, you don't want to pay the $100 to replace the score. So So I did, you know, a fair bit of analysis for something like this, and I also got pretty lucky in the process. And in fact, I ended up rebuying twice. Both times, I believe it was definitely right, and I ended up getting second place in the tournament. So, you know, it really does behoove you to do a little bit of homework in something like this. And granted, I got lucky, but if I hadn't done this analysis, I probably would have just said, oh, it's $100 and you don't even get the option, so it's not worth it. And I might not have done as well as I did.
Yeah, we've said on the show before many times that if you're in any tournament or any kind of event, it's definitely worth your time to read the rules very carefully. And if they're indicated in multiple places, read them every single place they occur. Because you know, you want to invoke every single rule that works your way.
That's true. And sometimes you need to argue. Sometimes you need to ask two people and see if they agree. And sometimes they don't. And then, a good debater can sometimes get a good ruling on an obscure point. So if you sit back and, oh, they'll figure it out, you're often going to take the worst of it.
Yeah, I think every kid learns that if you don't like the answer you get from one parent, ask the other one. And this works in the casinos too, and not just in tournaments. If you ask anyone for something and they say no, ask somebody else.
Well, I was the second one in our family, and my sister was real goody-goody and never asked for anything. And so I learned this technique of asking both parents. By the time my younger siblings came along, my parents were wise to this trick, so they couldn't get away with anything. I don't know that they've ever forgiven me for this. So, good. Ryan, have you in video poker, have you ever accidentally played less than maximum coins on a machine?
Okay, so I told you my favorite casino story. This is now my least favorite casino story. So, I've since been able to, with a lot of therapy, try to get over this, but...
You are kidding.
No, I didn't seriously do any therapy, but I'll tell you my rationale for how I can live with myself after this. But up until the point of this story, I had probably played about 1.5 million deals of video poker, which is a substantial amount for a recreational player especially.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure it pales in comparison with the sort of numbers that you might put up year to year.
I've had many years with more than that, but that could be at least 6 or 7 months of a good year. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. And, I would like to say that I've never played without maximum coins, because that's how you optimize the machine, but I would be incorrect in saying that. I was playing a triple play $5 machine at a downtown casino. And this particular machine, normally when you play the triple play or any sort of video poker machine, if you don't have enough credits in the machine, what you'll do is you'll hit max bet. And normally the max bet button just bets max and starts the game. On this particular machine, you had to hit the max bet button, which would basically fill it up with the coins needed, and then you would push deal. You had to do both steps to make the machine work. Well, with triple play, you have to have 15 coins in to play a full time. And I had gotten down to 10 coins, and of course I was playing at a fairly rapid pace. I didn't notice that my max bet had not filled up the machine completely, and I hit deal. And they dealt me the ace, king, queen, jack of diamonds with another random card that I threw away, knowing exactly what was going to happen. And not one, but two royal flushes. Now, of course, the distribution, it doesn't give you two hands of five, which would have been just fine. It actually gives you a 4-3-3 distribution, which is the silliest result you can ever get on a video poker machine. So I won, and I got a jacks are better on the third one, just a little extra value. But I won $8,765 instead of over $40,000. And the worst part about this is that as I sat there waiting for my jackpot, which of course is always a good thing, all sorts of people came by to congratulate me on this. And I was just feeling like I had lost $32,000 or whatever. And since then, and of course my friends made a lot of fun of me and they will never let me live that down. But the way that I look at it is the way the random number generator works, I had to have pushed the buttons at the right time down to a microsecond and a half or whatever the clock speed was in the game. And if I had paused to get more money into it, I don't think I would have gotten those particular cards. So that's how I choose to look at it.
Yeah, there are people who would say that winning a mere $8,000 on a hand isn't the worst. And if your worst thing that ever happened in a casino is you won $8,000 on a hand, you must have a fantastic casino career.
Or a very perverse way of looking at things, which is probably the case.
Yeah, it makes for an interesting philosophical question. Did you just win $8,000 or lose $32,000? And I agree with how you looked at it in that you only got that royal because you hit the button at the exact right instant. And, had you made a, the full bet, you wouldn't have bet at the exact same moment. So I would have only been mad at myself to the extent of expected value that you lost.
Right. But one hand out of a million and a half, I mean, that's kind of twisted.
Well, most of us have had, like on a multi-game machine, where, let's say we're playing jacks or better, that's the best game on that machine, it runs out of coins, and so you're feeding it, or before it feeds it, you go away, and it comes back, and it resets to the default, which is, say, Joker Wild. So frequently, the game the machines reset at as the default mode is the lowest-paying game on the machine. So instead of a 99.5% game, now you're at a 97% game. And most of us have played a few hands occasionally on the wrong game simply because the machine switched on us at a time when we weren't expecting it. If that has never happened to you, Brian, you are a most unusual man. Most unusual man.
Because that one I don't think has happened to me, actually, because I get pretty anal about those things, I guess. But have you ever gotten anything tragic that way? Like if you were playing deuces and it reset and you got four deuces on a non-deuces wild machine or anything really horrible?
Well, I've actually done well that way. I am not somebody who obsesses about what might have been. So I know players who, when they get, say, three cards to a royal and a high pair, then they play the hand and then they go and check to see if the first two cards out would have filled in the royal. And so they want to know if they should really have a right to really feel bad that by holding the high pair, they cost themselves 4,000 coins. So I don't do that. But I know a lot of people who do, and I think it's pretty silly.
I agree. Yep. The cards on the draw are constantly being shuffled, and it's exactly when you press draw that determines what you get. And, you're not going to take the exact same amount of time depending upon whether you hold the three to the royal or the high pair, because it takes a little extra time to press that extra button.
It does.
Or not press it.
But I think if somebody really wants to feel bad about this, they have the right to feel bad. Don't you? I would not want to take that right away from them. Would you, Michael?
I think I might. I don't like it when players believe in myths, and I never correct. I never give unsolicited advice, but I'm also happy to answer questions if I get asked. And right. Lots of times you hear myths, like just standing in the elevator, and I just want to shake my head, but you know I don't say anything.
All right. So, Brian, thank you. We are going to let you go. If you stick around, we have another question for you. If we have time at the end, we don't know if we will. But whether you stick around or not, we thank you very much for being here. It's very informative.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks.
All right. Michael, what did we learn tonight?
Well, I already knew this, but we learned to always check the casino rules very carefully in a tournament and any kind of event, and to not just throw around playing cards on the casino floor cavalierly.
I'm not sure we learned that. That might be fun. That might be fun. But you and I are probably too well known in a casino, and that we're too mature to do things like that.
Yeah, I'm afraid that they would run back the footage and surveillance and recognize me and call me and say, why were you throwing cards around the floor?
Yep, that's a possibility. All right, now, what's happening on the various Wizard websites?
On the Wizard of Odds, I added a section on a side bet at the Golden Nugget called Wild Aces, which is a very simple side bet that if your first card is an ace, you can make a side bet that the next card will be any 10-point card, kind of like insurance. I added a section on Triple Diamond Keno, which has only been out there for 16 years, but I finally got around to writing about it. But I'm most proud of a game that I just put up called One Card Poker. This is a simple version of poker where you play against the dealer and you get only one card. And it was rather complicated developing a strategy for this game, but I think it's a fun little game, so I'm pretty proud of it.
Has your One Card Poker been trademarked? Or the game patented or anything like that?
I have a patent pending on it, and I asked my patent attorney about a trademark, and he said that it was just
not worth it.
Yeah, did not bother with that.
Okay, so now this is a game where you start with $100, and the deal rotates each time. So you bet, you and the dealer bet $1, and whichever one of you bets first, he either calls or raises, bets another $1. And so then the other one folds, or raises again.
Yep, it's basically a structured poker game with a maximum pot of $8 or 8 units. And so you can check, raise, fold, re-raise. So I view it as like a microcosm of poker, and I was trying to get at in doing this some... I was trying to get at the essence of the game of poker, and I'm not sure that I found it. But it was Arnold Snyder, when he was on the show, as he was talking about a simplified version of poker, and that's what inspired me to do this.
So does a dealer bluff?
Oh, absolutely. One thing I did learn from this is that you should be bluffing a lot, and lots of times the dealer will raise on very low cards, like a 2 or a 3, with a certain percentage of the time. There's a certain optimal percentage of the time, and I think what I learned about my own game of poker through this exercise is that I wasn't bluffing enough.
So is it your estimation that if somebody who played this a half hour against this optimal dealer, the player has a very small chance of being ahead after a half hour?
If it depends on the player's strategy, I claim that the best the player can do against this game is break even. But if the player plays badly, then he's going to be playing at a disadvantage. Kind of like a 100.0% video poker game. The casino is basically just hoping the player makes mistakes on that. which is much the same premise as my game.
So you believe you have your dealer plays optimally?
Yes, and there's not just one optimal strategy. There's a certain range of strategies that are optimal, and I chose one that I think is right in the middle of ways that the dealer could play optimally to hopefully maximize the possibility of player errors.
Uh-huh. Very good. So it's a middling optimal strategy.
Yes.
All right. So would it be a different optimal strategy if you normally play against good players or you normally play against bad players? I would think there would be different strategies depending on who the opponents were.
Oh, I agree. Like, if I know exactly what the player's strategy is, I would develop a strategy to take full advantage of that. But I don't know how, you know, the multitudes out there are going to play against my game. So I just came up with a strategy that is just a conservative strategy that can't be beaten. Although if the player is decent, the player can't, my game can't beat the player either.
Okay, well, I'm pretty sure yours could be beaten if somebody knew what it was. But
I would say not.
If they knew what it was?
Right. I could tell you exactly what my strategy is, and I claim that it cannot be beaten.
Interesting. Then, were that true, I don't see how there could be several optimal strategies. I mean, one of them has to be optimum optimorum or whatever that is.
Well, in studying simplified version of this game where, say, there was only one raise allowed, I found that for some situations, the probability of, say, bluffing could be anywhere between, say, 20% and 40%, and still lead to and still be optimal.
Very good. All right. South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anyone else. This month, they have a virtual NASCAR promotion four times a day, Sunday through Thursday, 3:30, 4:30, 7:30, and 8:30. All players who played $50 coin in the previous hour are eligible. You pick one of the eight drivers, and then they have a race on a tiny TV on your machine. Players who select the winning driver share in a $5,000 prize per race. On Halloween, there will be two times points on video poker. I will be there. This coming Tuesday at noon, I'll be teaching Deuces Bonus Poker. This is a popular combination of Deuces Wild and Bonus Poker. The following week, I'll be teaching Double Bonus Deuces Wild. So on certain values are changed. Particularly between those two games, different values of full houses, different values of flushes relative to each other. Now, if you attend both classes, you'll become very knowledgeable about how those two pay table elements affect strategies in various other Deuces Wild games as well. The Palms. The Friday-Saturday night drawings this month total $100,000. It ends this Saturday. At each drawing, 10 winners win between $100,000 and $3,000. And in a separate drawing, five of these people win an entry into the finals Saturday, October 27th. Where one player will walk away with $50,000. There's 40 people trying for this $50,000, assuming they all show up this Saturday night. And it's common to make deals with each other as to, like if Michael and I each had one ticket, we might, for example, if I win, I would give him $10,000, or if he wins, he would give me $10,000. This would not change our expected value, but it would reduce our variance. So there's an infinity of ways to do this, but the most, and I'm going to be writing an article on this, which will be seen after this particular event takes place, but the key factor is making sure you know what you're doing related to taxes. If Michael and I had this deal, but I thought the winner had to pay all the taxes, and he thought there was going to be 1099s back and forth, then depending on who won, one of us could be mighty irritated at the other for not having this settled in advance. So the best way is to settle it up front. The VideoPoker.com free monthly contest for October features 100 play with Super Times Pay. The contest started yesterday. and they made a interesting change to the game in that to honor Halloween, if you get one of the multipliers, you get spooky Halloween sounds. Now, the most intelligent game to play is Double Double Bonus. That has the best variant. So in the first 24 hours, somebody got dealt four aces and a kicker with a 5x multiplier for 100,000 points. And so you're going to have to do better than that. So it has to do with what you're dealt. You want good hands with good multipliers. Next week, we have Stacy Colombo Alonso. She is Vice President of Marketing from IGT. In 2 weeks, we will have Arnold Snyder talking about his new book, Risk of Ruin. Now, Michael, you talked about maybe going on some trips, casino trips across the country. Tell me about what you were thinking.
Yeah, I'm the kind of person that gets itchy to travel somewhere once in a while. And I went to Argentina and Uruguay just about a year ago. And about a year before that, I went to Panama. And I just feel that I'm overdue to go somewhere. However, I'm not sure an international trip is in the cards right now. So I thought maybe I would just check out somewhere in the country that I haven't been for a while or ever. One option is Oklahoma, which is becoming a booming casino market. The last time I was there was just some class 2 slot casinos, but now they have full-blown casinos there and very big ones from what I hear. Or maybe Detroit. Haven't been there since they legalized gambling, and I haven't been to Atlantic City in about 13 years. So do you have any advice for me?
Well, Detroit is more fun in June than it is in February.
Because?
Weather. Michigan is God's country in the spring. It is a lovely place. It is very nice temperatures and stuff. In the wintertime, not so much fun. It's pretty cold up there. It's right on the lake, and it's pretty cold. I taught at Greektown in Detroit. It's gone through a couple ownership changes since then. They have an MGM Grand there, which is very similar to what they have here. Brian, are you on the line, Brian?
Yes.
All right. So we got a minute to tell him about Atlantic City.
Oh, yeah. If you come by, definitely give me a call.
Sure.
You can go over.
Well, that's good. Having somebody hold your hand is always great. So, and I don't know anything about Oklahoma. I know they have a real good football team, and they're going to kick Notre Dame's butt this week. But I don't really know anything about the gambling there.
Yeah, I haven't been to Atlantic City in a while. How has it changed in the last 13 years?
It really hasn't changed all that much, I would have to say. I mean, aside from, I know your preferred table games and everything, so there are more of those, but that's generally a good thing. Different kinds, I should say.
And dealers tend not to be as good there as they are in Las Vegas, so there's more chance for dealer error, which is how players prosper.
Yes.
I didn't know that the dealers are worse there.
I would think the dealers in Las Vegas are more practiced. The dealers in new casino areas tend to be hired locals, and they don't have near as much experience. So, yeah, I'm sure there's a skill difference.
Okay.
So, well, we're almost out of time. So I want to thank Brian again, and I want everybody to go out and hit lots of royal flushes. And
okay, good night, everybody.
And good night. Thank you, Brian.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.